Good afternoon. So last time we talked about first more ways of exploiting buffer overflows. And one idea we mentioned was arc injection. That previously when we were talking about overwriting some important function pointer or pointer to machine code like a return address, our kind of assumption was that we'd write our own machine code and overwrite a pointer to that. And the reason we did that is that, well, we assumed that if the attacker wants the program to do something it's not designed to do, then we'd have to write that code because it's not going to be in the program. But we found out that, well, that's sometimes not true, and including in very practical situations. We have this example of NTP where the program called stringlen because it was reading a string from the network and getting its length. And, well, that stringlen call, you know, if we change what function's being called, which we could do because it was done with some indirection, well, maybe instead of getting the length of the string, it could execute the string as a program to run from disk. And we're going to see this idea again of, you know, that the useful code is already present after we talk about sort of one of the obvious proposals people have when we talk about shellcode in the first place, which is that, well, can we just not let people write new code and run it, which we're going to look at today. Then we also talked about pointer subterfuge, because often, you know, it's going to turn out that we have a buffer overflow and the buffer is not in any obvious way near a function pointer. Because, well, either just, you know, a lot of buffers are in data structures that don't contain function pointers, or because we went to deliberate effort to keep the function pointers away from the data structure, like by implementing stack canaries and maybe some other defenses we come up with that would be similar. And pointer subterfuge is the idea, well, we don't actually need to overwrite a pointer to a function or other machine code. We can overwrite a data pointer, and that's usually just as useful because what's going to happen is, well, that points to some data. We can make it to another pointer, and we can turn this into an arbitrary memory write that lets us overwrite function pointers. And this is going to get to sort of a common theme, is that, you know, we'll often have these more exploits for these memory management issues where it's not just one step. We don't just overflow and we're done. We're going to have a few steps. And we saw in the example of exploiting pointer subterfuge that, you know, there was one step where we overwrote a pointer and a second step where we got the program to use our overwritten pointer. And by sort of combining those together, we could end up making the program do what we wanted. And it's often very practical to make that happen because programs are running loops, you know, especially if they're like reading from the network or reading from a file, there's kind of a loop they're running, and we can take advantage of that to, you know, do one thing in the first pass, another thing in the second pass. In this case, first pass overwrite that pointer, second pass use the overwritten pointer. Then we did a brief diversion into the idea of overflows on the heap. So previously we looked at overflows on the stack and overflows sort of in global variables, where in both cases it was kind of clear how we have things next to each other. And on the heap, this was less clear. We mentioned that, well, it turns out that often when we have things allocated with newer malloc, that if we allocate two different things with newer malloc, they'll end up next to each other. That's just how the new and malloc implementations work. But we mentioned that that didn't have to be the case, and that we could do something like place some other memory in between. And to talk about that, we need to talk about, well, how does memory get managed in general? And I mentioned the idea that many of you may have seen in 3330 or 4414 if you've taken those courses or whatever the compy course that covers paging is, and that we just gave our brief review of is that, well, there's this table the hardware reads, which has an entry for basically 4K chunks of program addresses that says, what's the real address? This exists not primarily to implement security features, but primarily so we can have multiple programs loaded at the same time and have the OS decide what memory addresses they use. But this table has information about not only what address each of these ranges of virtual addresses map to, but also whether it's readable or writable. So one way we can take advantage of this for security purposes is that we can say, oh, if I don't want going past the end of the buffer to work, I could just make sure the memory there is not readable or writable. And as long as we have a contiguous overflow, it's not one of those ones where we like can skip over something, then, you know, if we go past the end of our buffer onto that deliberately unreadable area, then we expect a crash. And this is a technique that, you know, is pretty effective and relatively low overhead as far as time, but the performance impact is mainly because it takes up space, that we have to do this in whole page chunks, that if we want to allocate one of these things that's going to crash when you read or write it, it's a page that's typically at least 4 kilobytes. If we want to have one of these for every object we allocate, we have to give that object its own page just before that 4 kilobyte chunk. So this means that if we're allocating, you know, 100 byte thing, well, to make this happen, that it's right up against the next guard page, we have to allocate 4K for it, put it at the end of that 4K we allocated, and put the guard page next. And this means that this technique, well, it's, if we did it all the time, we'd waste a lot of memory. There's also a performance impact in that to set up each of these guard pages, we need to ask the OS to change this table. This is not something we're going to be able to do directly. Why not? Because, well, if we could change it directly, then this would probably let us access memory we're not supposed to. And because we have to ask the OS, that means it's going to be slower than it would be to just return a pointer to something that is already set up, which is what malloc is typically going to want to do. So we're going to look more at, you know, ways we can take advantage of these permissions. But before I move on to that, questions about any of this stuff we covered last time? First, a logistical note. So if you've been looking at the assignment list, the next assignment after the overflow assignment that's due this week was previously listed as format. It changed to subterfuge. So basically, I had an old assignment, which was a format string exploit, and my thoughts were that, well, hopefully this problem has gone away. I'm not sure that's actually true, but hopefully it has. So it'd be more useful to do something that's a pointer subterfuge exercise, because even with the mitigations we've seen, like address space randomization making it more complicated, it's still something you're likely to see in a real program. And I sincerely hope all the printf libraries don't allow the %n thing to work anymore. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but I hope it's true. And when looking this up, you know, I found out, well, the first time they tried to make this checking work, it didn't actually fix the problem because it could be bypassed with a format string that was just a little funny and had triggered an integer overflow. But I hope that it works now and will continue to work, so we never have to worry about this in the future for the overwriting part of the format string exploit. And just have to consider what about the, you know, sort of information leak that it creates. Okay. So, we cleaned up last time. We mentioned that the idea that, we could do guard pages for everything, but if we did them for, like, small objects, and this is sort of the sort of ranges of sizes you'd imagine are allocated in a common program, we'd end up that, well, you know, if each of these 100-byte objects, you know, if we allocate a guard page, we're going to have our 100-byte object, a guard page, and we're going to have this unused space because, well, we don't want something else to overflow into the 100-byte object. So, you know, we'd be, you know, basically multiplying the memory needed for these small objects by a factor of 40. So that's why malloc implementations don't do this all the time. They do, however, do it for large allocations. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense for large allocations because it's basically free to do for large allocations. When making a large many kilobyte allocation, a malloc or new implementation is typically going to ask the OS to change the page table, that, you know, that table with, you know, our real address mappings, to add new mappings anyways. So while it's doing that, we can just make sure the OS leaves a blank entry before and after. So that's easy. But for the smaller allocations, that would be really inefficient. And what malloc implementations do want to do instead is, like, get a bunch of stuff from the OS once and parcel it out in little bits. And this guard page idea is not compatible with that. There are malloc implementations which do this, but they're just for debugging because, you know, on a typical program, the overhead's going to be so, so high. And also, you could imagine that, you know, if this weren't so space inefficient, you could imagine doing this in other places. That if we cared about, say, stack buffer overflows, maybe we can just arrange for there to be a guard page in the middle of our stack. That rather than, you know, just pushing space, you know, subtracting from the stack pointer to add the buffer, we tell the OS, hey, can you give me an unallocated page here so I can make sure buffer overflows crash? And we could do that. It's just that this is would be very inefficient as far as space, because, you know, now instead of our function using, you know, a couple hundred bytes of stack space, we use over 4 kilobytes, and it would be very inefficient because of the overhead of needing to communicate with the OS, you know, and actually make these changes happen to this table. You could imagine a slightly less space inefficient version of this, where maybe what we could do is we could, you know, round out to the next page and make the return address temporarily read-only, and then reset that, you know, when we're done with the function before returning. We could, like, imagine this could be a possible alternative to the stack canary, but again, the issue is that, well, we have this space that seems very wasteful. It's less space than the alternate approach where we had this completely inaccessible page. And we have this problem that making the two edits we need to make to the page table requires contacting the OS each time, and that's going to substantially slow down our function. But I want you to keep these strategies in mind, because whenever we're thinking about protecting memory, if you just have to set it up once and then it's going to be there for a while, maybe the cost of setting these page table entries isn't significant. And, you know, once it's set up like this, this is actually very efficient. It's just the problem is that this, you need extra space to make it work, and setting it up is a bit slow. So if we look at these permission bits, something which comes up is that, oh, we can make memory read-only. And that has some uses with respect to some other things we've seen that are notable. And that's that, well, we wanted to overwrite pointers to functions. So like return addresses, function pointers, of various sorts, like in our local variables, in tables used for inheritance, and global offset tables. And some of these should not need to change very much. So here, for these last two, you know, these should be set up, these could be at least set up at program start, and then don't change. So for these, it seems like they mostly don't need to be written. So these other ones are problematic. You know, these are edited all the time when the program runs. But these values here, they don't seem to change much after the program starts. And we could take advantage of that and just make them not writable. So if they're not writable, then that's going to mean that if I want to now target a function pointer to make my exploit work, well, I have to find one of these other targets, and that's going to be harder. You know, we saw that when I saw it showed you that example of an NTP exploit, they used the global offset table. And why did they do that? Well, it was easy to figure out what its address was. Relative to everything else. It was called in a very well-known way. It was very convenient. And even though we aren't like completely solving the problem, these are going to be a lot less convenient to use, to overwrite. And this idea is in fact implemented on many systems, including Linux. So Linux has something called relocation read-only. So you talk about this name. So relocation is the, you know, the process of, you know, changing or filling in addresses when loading a program for a program. That's basically what it's referring to here. So when the dynamic link, when we load a dynamically linked program, we have to like fill in addresses in the global offset table and some other places. And this option, relocation read-only, says that after you're done doing that, after you're done doing the startup work, mark them as read-only. Make the extra work to tell the OS, hey, set that writable bit to false in all the page table entries for this stuff. And to make that work, there's a little work as far as linking time that we need to make sure that these structures appear in a different page than other stuff the program uses. So in sort of before we were doing this, maybe we could have put this the global offset table right next to the global variables. You know, so we have our global offset table and our variables. Here, we're going to probably have our global offset table and some padding and the variables to make sure that this is on, these are on separate pages. So we can mark the page containing the global offset table as read-only. And you'll be happy to know that this is on by default in pretty much all current Linux distributions, that if you compile a program, it's going to have this feature enabled. And if you've looked at object dump minus X output, you've probably seen a rel ro directive in the program headers that's related to this. What's not so great is that there's two types of rel ro support. There's partial and full. And as you might guess, partial is less good, and less good in a very meaningful way. So in partial rel relocation read-only, everything but the global offset table pointers to library functions are set read-only. You might say, well, these are kind of important. That was the example you used for that exploit. It's one of the easiest ways of taking advantage of things not being read-only. So this seems kind of problematic, and you might say, why would they do this? And the answer has to, you can kind of infer from what they do to make the full version work, and that is that you have to disable the lazy binding, the lazy linking, where the linker fills in the addresses in the global offset table as you call functions rather than all at program startup. So there's a performance cost that to do the full version, that means that the global offset table needs to be fully populated at program start, whereas with the partial version, it can be populated at runtime. Now, the partial version does help a bunch, and probably the most notable thing we've seen it helps with is that C++ virtual function tables are going to be marked read-only. These have to be generated by the linker because they contain addresses of functions that might be loaded in different places, especially if it's a library. And a question, does everything include return addresses? No, so sorry. I mean everything set up by the delinker. That's a good question. So this does not include things that the program writes on the stack. This does not include variables the program sets up itself. This is things that are set up by the linker. Other questions? Okay. So when I talked about being able to set things not writable and not readable, one thing that one of you mentioned was, well, can't we make it non-executable? And this is a great idea, and therefore has been implemented, and there's this many names for the idea of taking advantage of this, and typically the way we want to use this for security is that we want to enforce this property that memory is writable or executable, but not both, since exclusive OR. And this has many names, this sort of feature. So sometimes you'll get it called WriteX or execute. Microsoft, I think, liked using the name data execution prevention. We have the NX bit or the XD bit, which are names that Intel and AMD used for the hardware support that underlies this feature. And the idea is that we just make sure writable memory is never executable. We just enforce a property. We can even implement this in the OS that if it's writable memory, we're never going to let it be executable. And this seems to like make shellcode never work. That if you insert code in a buffer and try to point to it, well, the machine will crash, seg fault saying, you can't execute that buffer. And it seems like, okay, now users can't insert their machine code. We'll learn that this is an inconvenience for the attacker, but the attacker doesn't actually need to write new stuff that's executed to do what they want. That arc injection idea we can extend and make it work essentially all the time. When I show you the example with the system function, it seemed like we got lucky that we happened to have a function that was loaded and it happened to be called in the exact right way. And maybe that won't always happen. We're going to learn, it pretty much always happens. But it's an inconvenience at least, and it makes it a lot less obvious how to do anything. And you might say, this seems like a great idea. It's easy to implement. It doesn't even require, it seems, like recompiling applications like stack canaries. We had to recompile everything. It has no runtime overhead pretty much. So why is this something that apparently hasn't been happening all the time? Because I talked about stack smashing, and stack smashing was sort of the scourge of the 90s and the early 1000s. It was everywhere. And the answer is that it wasn't always supported in the hardware. That in, for example, early x86 processors, if it was readable, it was executable. There was no way the OS could specify this piece of memory is not executable. And support existed in it for 32-bit x86 only around 2000, and, well, if that's when support was added, the operating systems, like, didn't implement that right away because, you know, it only worked on the processors that came around about in 2000, so it took several years after that for operating systems to start enabling it. So also another thing is that you think, okay, you know, no program needs to execute things on the stack, right? And that's also not true. So unfortunately, there are ways that real programs out there, for not reasons of being exploited by someone doing stack smashing, would try to execute code on their stack or in other writable regions of memory like their heap. And some of these are very legitimate reasons. So just-in-time compilers, so your fast Java implementations and JavaScript implementations produce some machine code at runtime to execute the script or Java program. And, you know, that involves writing code and jumping to it. That's deliberately done. And if you implement this write X or execute idea, well, it's not going to work anymore unless those programs know that they have to make some sort of extra call to the operating system to say, hey, yeah, I wrote some code, now make it executable, please. They have to know they need to do that extra step, and if they weren't written that way, you can't just turn this feature on and expect those programs to work. And there's other cases where this came up. So for example, GCC used to support basically closures. So basically in Python, you can like do... this, and it will capture the information about y and return a function pointer, Python's equivalent of a function pointer. GCC used to support the equivalent of this for C by writing code on the stack. Another example is Linux has this feature where Unix has this feature in general where the OS can run a handle learner program when some event happens, like pressing Control C. And the historical implementation of this in Linux had the OS write the code to call that handler on the program stack while it was running. And that needed to be changed before the OS could enable this write X or execute feature. And that's on the stack. So we couldn't even disable executable stacks, which seemed like the easiest sort of metric for this. Like the heap, yeah, maybe programs that are like JITs are going to allocate stuff there, but even the stack where we would usually think there's no reason you'd execute something there, programs were taking advantage of that, operating systems were taking advantage of that, and after the hardware support was there, they needed a bunch of time to actually adjust things so they didn't use that anymore. So questions about this write X or execute idea and why it took so long to happen. Okay, so we're going to next talk about the idea I was alluding to by saying write X or execute, even though it seems like we stop the attacker from writing shellcode, doesn't really do it. And the reason why is a concept we're going to call return-oriented programming, that we can find a chain of existing machine code in the program that does what we want. And I'll give I'll give some examples. But basically the idea, we're going to hook these pieces of machine code together with return instructions that are already in them. And to illustrate this idea, I'm going to start with a recent exploit that sort of has this sort of simplest nugget of like why this is going to work. So to give some context, this is a bug in F5's load balancer. So F5 is a company that makes networking hardware for appliances, I guess would be the word they'd use. And they make load balancers. Load balancer is something that sits in front of a bunch of web servers and divides the traffic up among them. And F5 has a really bad security record. And it had a stack buffer overflow. And you say, okay, great. So, you know, can we exploit this? Well, they didn't use ASLR. So the addresses of their program aren't randomized generally, and they didn't enable write X or execute even. You might wonder why, given what year it is. This is a 2021 exploit. But there's a problem here that you couldn't do the straightforward stack smashing thing because the stack address was actually randomized. They didn't disable that OS feature. Yes, the program was loaded at a fixed address, but that was only because there was a hard-coded address in the binary. The OS actually randomized the address of the stack in the heap. So they couldn't do stack smashing. So here is someone's tweet with a handy proof of concept written in Go. And what they're putting in the return address is this address. So and they mention, well, by the variable name, that this is the address of a jump RSP instruction that just happened to be sitting around in the original executable that was running. And it's probably reasonable to think, wait a moment, why is there a jump RSP? We should never write that instruction. Jump RSP means jump to the stack. It's an instruction which can only execute code in the stack, which no one would ever want to do, we'd hope. And in this program, yeah, F5 wasn't trying to execute code in the stack, most likely. So why did that happen? Why were they able to jump to their shellcode? Their example shellcode here is the trigger a debugger breakpoint code, but this could have been anything, is why this is a proof of concept. So why was there a jump RSP instruction there? And I don't have a copy of this binary, but it turns out a lot of programs have a jump RSP instruction. And I say, wait a moment, you know, how? And the reason is that, well, it's not really a jump RSP instruction. So for example, I looked at bin bash on my desktop. Just, you know, I chose a program and I said, I'm going to find jump RSP in this program. And I did. Here it is. The machine code is FFE4. That's a jump RSP. It's right there. You might say, well, that's not a jump RSP. It's a move. This is what object jump is telling you. It's a move instruction. No, it's a move. But the processor doesn't think it's a move if I jump to this location and not the one at the beginning of the move instruction. And because we can do things like jump to the quote-unquote middle of an instruction, that means that, you know, we have a lot of options for what instructions we're going to be able to find. And this means that it's very rare for a program to not have useful instructions. So, questions about this example? So one question, if the stack address is randomized, isn't that the same as ASLR? So probably I should say they didn't fully enable ASLR. That'd probably be a better description of what happened. Does that answer the question? So the question is, what's the difference? So basically what happened here is that the executable was loaded to a fixed address. Address, but the stack and heap and libraries were probably randomized. So we could take advantage of the executable being loaded to a fixed address here to get to find the code we want to run without having to figure out, you know, what the addresses that were randomized are. Other questions? So a question, isn't the executable always fixed though? So the answer is no. So if you compile a program on sort of the version of Linux that's in our VM, you'll get by default, unless you do something different, an executable which can be loaded at any address, which is a deliberate feature to make these sorts of exploits not work as easily. That, however, wasn't the case until relatively recently, and I'll probably talk about why a bit later. And I guess I should mention, yes, some of the programs I gave you for assignments don't have those things randomized, and that is me actually adding a compiler option to make that happen. Other questions? Okay. So, this idea that we're going to find these snippets of useful code, machine code, in the program is what we can take advantage of, it turns out, to do pretty much anything. And typically, our snippets aren't going to be things that look like jumps, but what we're going to start with is snippets that end with returns. And I'm going to give an example of that with a stack overflow, because stack overflow is going to be the easiest thing, you know, most natural thing to use using this technique, but we'll also see that it works for other types of buffer overflows. So here I have a vulnerable application, and it's the same one we've seen before, but we're going to talk about how would we exploit this despite having write X or execute turned on. So we're not going to worry about stack canaries. That would be a problem. But we're going to have write X or execute turned on. So we can't do our stack smashing thing of actually overwriting the stack pointer and pointing to the buffer. Because if we return to the buffer, it's going to crash saying, hey, that's not executable memory. Sorry. So I first of all, I can read this, you know, assembly code to figure out, oh, after this many bytes is where the return address is. And then I need to figure out, okay, so where is a function that would be useful for me to return to? And how I'm going to do this is I'm going to say, well, I need to figure out where, you know, that code is going to be. And let's say, you know, I went to look in the C library. The C library is pretty big. It's likely to have a lot of interesting pieces of code if I just look around them. And so I just figure out, you know, where it's loaded. Let's say I figure out it's loaded at this address, which is what I found having it. And I'm going to try to use snippets of code in the C library to output a message, for example, of you have been exploited. So something similar to the virus code we showed for the tricky assignment, but I'm going to try to do this only using snippets of code that are already in the C library. And you might say, okay, well, you know, the puts function, this is a C library function. We want to just call puts, you have been exploited. So why don't we just set the return address to this value, which is the puts function. And then the return is basically calling puts. And The problem is that that doesn't take care of this argument. That that the value, that here is where that call would happen. You know, what's the value of RDI here? And you might say, oh, RDI is going to be the stack, it's going to be the buffer. And the answer is that, you know, it was the buffer here before the call to GetS, but after the call to GetS, GetS is going to change RDI because GetS made function calls of its own. It didn't, wasn't under any obligation to restore the old value of RDI. So RDI has the wrong value here. So with that knowledge, what we want is we just want some way of fixing up the address of RDI. So we need to look for some snippet of code that's going to fix up the address of RDI and then jump to put S. So like this is sort of the code we're going to want to emulate. And, you know, we have to make these operations happen. So we went to load a string into RDI, then, you know, jump to put S, basically, is what we want to do. And we can try to look for code which does this, but we're not going to find it. Like, there's no piece of code that does all of this in the existing program, you know, even if we, like, accept lots of variations. So we're going to do this in two pieces. So the first piece is I'm going to try to find a way of doing this first operation here of loading a string into RDI and then going to some other piece of code. So here's one of those. So I just looked in libc and I said, oh, there's a piece of snippet of code that already exists, which moves up the stack pointer into RDI and calls a function. So the stack pointer, well, I can make sure the string that's at the stack pointer when we return is going to be the right one. And calling RAX, well, to make this work, I just need some way of making RAX contain the right value and then going to the snippet of code. So, so what I'm going to set up here is I'm going to say overwrite. So it seems like I overwrite that if I had RAX have the right value, I just make it point to this. If RAX contained the address of putS already, I make it point to this and I get the behavior that, oh, I have my RDI string loaded, my string loaded from the stack pointer into RDI, and this call would happen. But the problem is that this will call the wrong place. That RAX, when this happens, is not going to be set right. So I'm going to want to combine this with something which changes RAX. So I'm going to look for something which changes RAX, and looking around in the program, I find this sequence of instructions, pop, return. Pop from the stack into RAX, and then return. So if we think about our stack, that if the stack pointer is here, this is going to pop the first thing on the stack into RAX and, you know, return to the second thing on the stack. And the new stack pointer is going to point after that when that next thing is called. So I can chain this and then execute the call snippet. And what's the call snippet going to do? Well, it's going to make a pointer to here, to the stack pointer when it runs, and then call the thing in RAX. So the chain I'm going to end up with is that when I overflow the buffer, I'm going to overwrite the return address with a pointer to this pop return gadget. And When the vulnerable function returns, it's going to call return, and it's going to jump based on that return to run this pop. The pop is going to get this address of putS and put it in RAX for us. Then it's going to run this return, which is going to jump to this second gadget, which I've placed the address of on the stack, knowing that the return would use it. This second gadget's going to copy the stack pointer to RDI and call a function. That function, because of this prior pop, is going to be putS. So questions about how this ends up calling putS? So if we kind of assemble a list of all the gadgets we have, and most of them we're going to look at in this sort of format, where we have a bunch of stuff and then a return. That's where the name return-oriented programming comes from. That we're going to chain these things together. Why can we chain them together? Because after we return, we've set up the stack pointer for the next gadget to pop and return using the information that's next on the stack. So this guy kind of forms a sort of a mini programming language that's unique to every program we'd exploit. So let's do a little exercise. Now let's say I want to call example with an argument of 0. What would be some ways of doing this? So what should I put on the stack? Remember, we're going increasing addresses. So I have the first, the return address of the vulnerable function, and then other things on the stack. And hopefully I... Okay, so I'll give another 10 seconds or so. Looks like you have a lot of answers in. So, okay. So, I guess, so I think a majority have, I guess a half of you have selected a correct answer. Let's talk about some of the answers in order. So one answer that was proposed is that we write OX1000 and then OX10001200. So let's think about this. We have, so this is increasing addresses and our stack grows in the other direction. I maybe should have made that explicit. So this is increasing addresses. This is the way our grows. And if we set the return address to OX10000, and then one proposal we selected is having OX1200 after it, what's going to happen is we're going to return from the function that, you know, has the buffer overflow buffer to OX1000 and run the example function. But when we've done that, we wouldn't have actually fixed up the argument of zero. So this solution doesn't work. And the issue is just that, the first thing that runs is the example function because it's the return address, which is the first thing in our buffer runs first. So, because the stack grows downwards, return increments the stack pointer. So, yeah. So the first address in buffer is used first. So these answers which have OX10000 first don't work because the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to execute a return instruction with the stack pointer on top of that address and go to the example function, and it's too late. We've ran example with the wrong arguments. So you need to do something that sets RDI to zero. So one option is running this instruction here. And so this is a wrong solution, but a correct solution, therefore, would be to have return to this first. So in that case, we'll run this XOR instruction, EDI, and therefore RDI will become zero. And then we'll return again. And when we return the second time, the stack pointer will point just above the prior return address because return incremented it previously. And we'll end up running the example function. So this is a correct solution. There's another correct solution on the list of options I provided, and that's that we could run this pop here, and that pop is going to read a value from the stack. So we can put zero for it to read, and then we can put the address that we want to jump to. So the pop would pop off the zero, and the return would go to the example function. So those are our two correct solutions. Okay, so questions about how I came up with these? And there's a question. So that is chaining only possible with return-oriented programming? So can it be done with a regular buffer overflow? So we'll talk later about if we don't have a buffer overflow that writes over a return address, how can we get this same effect? And the answer is often that we can. We just need to do some work to find some way of setting the stack pointer to a known value. So a question of what would happen if we did the choice of having, I'll use yet a different color. So what would happen if we did the OX1100 followed by OX1000 choice. So what would happen here is that this would, the code here is pop RDI. So RDI is going to get set to OX1000. And then it's going to return. And after we've popped, the return address points to here. And this is the, you know, jumps to this address. Address from the return. And we don't know what that is because it wasn't part of what we overwrote. So probably a crash, but maybe something else. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay, so let's do a second version of this. See. And I want to run this system command running, passing the string binsh. This is expected to be a null terminated pointer, pointer to a null terminated string. So how can I do that? And one of the addresses I've supplied to you is the address of some global variable. Why are we going to use that? So the strategy that you would likely use for this is that you'll try to write this string to that global variable and then pass a pointer to that global variable to the system function. Okay, we very much do not have any sort of consensus. With about half of you responding. through another 15 seconds or so. So the big thing I like to think about here is I want to get this string somewhere in memory, and my idea is I'm going to put it in this global variable. And if I look at my operations, I only have conveniently one option which can write something to that global variable, which is this move RDI RAX. So to make that work, though, I need to set up RDI and RAX with a known value. So I should, before I use this, I should be using both of these, which none of the pre-written options we did. So the correct response was none of these. So what should we actually do? So I want to load into this global variable this string. So how am I going to do that? Well, first I'm going to load the string into RDI and the address of the global variable into RDX. So to load the string into RDI, I can use this pop return. So this is pop RDI return. And the thing that's going to be popped, I want to be the string, at least the fir- as an 8-byte value, which conveniently looks like that. And then I want it to return to load the address into RAX. So I'm going to use the pop RAX gadget to do that. And the address I want to load is 0x2000. And then I can finally use the move gadget to copy into that global variable this string. So I've set up the string, but I'm not ready to call system yet. And the problem is that RDI contains the characters of this string, doesn't contain a pointer to it. So I need to load that pointer, which is going to be a pointer to the global variable, into RDI. So I use the pop RDI gadget again with the pointer. I probably should have thought of how much I'd have to write before doing this. So let's move this over to a new column. So we're going to consistent coloring here. So we're going to do the pop RDI to load the address. And then we're going to actually go return to the function. So this is pop RDI ret, and the ret actually goes to our system function. So a good question here is, why did I bother using this global variable instead of pointing RDI to the stack? And so there's an advantage I got by using this strategy of writing a global variable, and that's that I could work with just this information. I didn't need to know where the stack was. And this is going to be helpful when we talk about, we're going to talk more about ASLR. We're going to find out the addresses of some things, but not everything. So if I know the address of the executable code in global variables, that's going to be enough for this. I don't need to know where the stack is. And the question is, couldn't I use the call pop trick to get the stack address? So it is probably the case I could find some gadgets that would let me, yes, get the stack address and put it somewhere useful. So another strategy besides writing to a global variable would have been to write the value somewhere on the stack and make a pointer to that value on the stack. It's a little tricky because I want to make sure that where I would write the value or make the pointer doesn't interfere with the other stuff I'm doing on the stack. But absolutely, that is a strategy that you will see used in these ROP chains. But it's not one we can execute with these gadgets. We need some extra gadgets that do something with RSP, like in our example here, where we had this gadget that used RSP. And I should say, yes, I'm using the term gadget. So the term of art for these little snippets of assembly is a gadget. So other questions? Okay, so I've shown you that, you know, if we find these little snippets of code, we can construct all these sorts of useful operations, and it generally turns out that pretty much this means that, you know, we don't need to write shellcode. We can write this sort of weirdo shellcode instead and do everything we would have ever wanted to do with that shellcode. You say, so how did you find these gadgets? I had this real example where I somehow found these instructions. Did I open up libc and object dump and just scan through it? And the answer is no. I used a tool that does it, including one we'll use in an upcoming homework. So people just write tools which basically look at the machine code part of a binary of an executable or library, look for, say, return instructions, and try disassembling stuff before it and see what they get. And there's just a tool which does that. It lists everything it finds in its output. You can text search for what instruction you want to run. And that's just automated. So the program we use to do that, so it's called something called ROP gadget. And for example, I can run it on bin ls and it gives me output like this. I've omitted the first, 6,000 or so lines, but it tells me, oh, here are all the things that you might be interested in running. And how is it working? It's basically just saying, here are instructions that cause a jump. And we're just going to try disassembling 1 byte before, 2 bytes before, 3 bytes before, 4 bytes before, and so on. And discard every case where you get an invalid instruction, sort the list, here you go. And because we often find these useful things, this tool, in fact, has kind of an automated mode. It has a mode which just tries to create an ROP chain blindly. It just says, well, usually we find certain gadgets this is not what it does. So tries to open a, oh no, sorry. Yes. I remember what I did this slide for. So it tries to make a chain which opens a command line. So you can run it with this ROP chain option. And when it works, it will give you a little Python program that will execute a shell that will produce the stuff you would put in the buffer overflow to execute a shell. And it does this by just having sort of patterns that it has hard-coded. This means it doesn't always work. So for example, when I ran it on bin ls, it couldn't find the right gadgets in bin ls, so it couldn't make it work. It said, oh, I needed a way to write a value to a pointer because that I was looking for something with this pattern, didn't find one. That doesn't mean you can't do this. That means that you need to be a little more clever than the automated solution. So I said that there's this generic sort of make you know, open a command line. If you, say, had this clever idea of let's just make it so the command line doesn't exist in our system, then you make a chain which, like, makes memory executable and jumps there, or which, you know, sort of does something else. And you can do this generically for, like, a shared library. So a common tactic will be, you know, we'll make a version of this which works on this version of the C library, and then you can reuse it across many applications. So the question of, like, why would we ever, you know, why is this tool, does this tool have legitimate uses? So commonly, if you tell someone that they've developed an application that is vulnerable to a buffer overflow, they're going to tell you that, so what? It's not exploitable. And that's probably most of the legitimate use of tools like this, is that when people look at, you know, people often will insist that just because there's a buffer overflow doesn't mean I should really fix it, because it's not exploitable. And that's not true because of things like these return-oriented programming chains, but you need a tool like that to get there. So that's the biggest legitimate, quote-unquote, use of tools like this. But it's a good question, yes. This is mostly a tool that's going to produce exploits, so you have to have a reason for doing that. It also, like, might tell you about how good some naive defenses against return-oriented programming are. So, like, one idea people sometimes have is, let's just make it so there's no interesting gadgets in the program. You might think about, and this would be how you'd evaluate whether that's really true or not. So questions on this idea of automatically finding these gadgets and, you know, sort of this idea that there are these generic chains that we don't need to do this work over and over again each time. Okay, so far it seems like that we have that this return-oriented programming technique is great for exploiting stack overflows, but it's not clear how to apply this to non-stack exploits. But this is most commonly how, on a modern system, you have to do something like return-oriented programming for a non-stack exploit because of that write X or execute. You can't just point a pointer to your own machine code that you inserted, so you have to set something up. And most frequently, people will mostly use the return way, and they'll, like, kind of set up the return-oriented programming stuff by trying to change the stack pointer to a value they control. So an example might be that, let's say I find these two gadgets here, which I, you know, found in my C library. Well, this is going to be something I can actually use, sort of chained together, to set the stack pointer and start running code on that, using that new stack pointer. And how that would work? Well, what the first gadget does is it pushes RDI to the stack and calls RDX. And if we, before we run this, set up RDX to point to the second gadget, then the second gadget would pop RDI into RSP and then return to that new RSP, using that new RSP, which you know, we'd specify with RDI. And conveniently, RDI would be where the first argument to a function goes, and RDX would be where the third argument goes. So if we, say, overwrote a function pointer, we could overwrite it to point to the first gadget, make sure it gets run with an argument that is where what we want for the stack pointer, like a string pointer we control for the first argument, and make sure that the third argument has the value that is the address of this second gadget here. So we can construct scenarios like this. Obviously, this is a lot of extra work. But because we can do this, we can usually sort of set up return-oriented programming and then use that kind of generic technique that we saw earlier. And I'll sort of go through this in more detail next time. This is where I'll leave off for today. Take questions before I sign off.
Yeah, I just had a quick question on the homework. So I was running it and it works totally fine in the debugger, and it works normally when I don't include the LD library environment variable. But when I include the environment variable, I get like an instruction, like invalid instruction, but it works in the debugger for some reason. So I can't debug
it. With the exec wrapper, it works?
So with the when I run like all of those flags on my C++ file, when I include the LD library and then the env flag, it will not work. It says illegal instruction, but it works without the LD library flag, and it works with the LD library flag and without in the debugger. So I can't debug the LD library thing.
Okay, the debugger is supposed to set so LD library path equal. Works with.
So maybe it has to do with the corruption, the stack corruption thing that you mentioned, but I didn't really understand that part either.
Yeah, I'm puzzled that the wrapper would work correctly, because it should set up so the program doesn't work. Like, it's not you're not trying to run your attack program that way, right? You're running
my attack program works without the env and the LD library, but with ASLR turned off. But it does not work when I set the LD library file to the file you gave, unless I run it in the debugger. So if I run a debugger, it's fine. But if I run outside of the debugger with the LD library, it'll just say illegal instruction, even though I have like a 350 byte NOPS
slug. You're in a VM though, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm in the VM again.
Okay.
So maybe it's a stack corruption, but I changed the stack pointer.
I guess so. Question is, where is the illegal instruction? When does that occur? Does that occur after the buffer gets overflowed or before?
So I know the buffer's overflowing properly. I think it's just maybe returning to the wrong spot. But then again, I can't tell because I can't debug it. Because when I debug it, it works totally fine.
Okay.
So I like do set args, and I set the LD library, and I set ASLR.
Yeah. What I'm wondering is whether the debugger's loading the wrong library, or it's just a position of the stack issue. So I guess another question is, so if you set the LD library flag but don't have libc in the current directory, does it work?
I could try that right now. Okay, let me move LD library. Do you want me to try with the debugger on or not?
Without. So, and I'll stop recording. I think it's probably not something worth recording.